Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
And I'm Grace Seegers.
And we've got a special guest for this episode. We're really excited to have him on the show. Matt Ford, writer on law, democracy, and courts for the New Republic, and somebody I really enjoy following on all social media apps. Matt, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Thanks so much. It's great to join you for this.
And our topic this time is a really interesting one. It's been in our kind of list of topics for a while, and we thought now was a good time to tackle it. We're going to talk about whether Star Wars fans need to get used to the idea of their favorite characters changing, sometimes in uncomfortable ways, or whether we need to find a better balance of giving the fans what they want while also giving them something they didn't necessarily expect. And the classic example of this is Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi, where fans meet him at the end of Force Awakens, and they see him for a few seconds, they get their expectations up, and then they find out in the next movie he's a bitter old man. And folks have debated for years how reasonable that is in terms of a character choice. We're not here to completely relitigate that, but I do think it's worth analyzing the backlash to that decision in the context of, you know, broader storytelling choices. We're not going to delve too deeply into the new Ahsoka show in this episode, although we will be discussing in the future, but folks are pretty frustrated that Ahsoka acts, some would say, quite differently in the show than she did in Clone Wars and Rebels. And how much of that is the actress? How much of that is the character evolving and maturing? We'll leave that up to other folks to discuss, at least until our Ahsoka episode. But that's another example of this tension between wanting a character to be the way you remember them and wanting them to have a realistic story of growth and maturity. So let's touch briefly on the case study of Luke Skywalker and how we see that in the context of this broader discussion. And Grace, maybe I could go to you first. When you think about how Luke changed, you know, over the course of, you know, from Return of the Jedi to The Last Jedi, do you see that transformation as logical and important for his story in Star Wars, or were you frustrated by it?
Well, listeners of the pod will know that I generally enjoy The Last Jedi, although I do have my serious issues with it. I've always thought that Luke's plotline in The Last Jedi makes sense. It's not something that really frustrated me. I can see how 20, 30 years passed and the man that you knew at the end of Return of the Jedi would necessarily be a different person. I think something that really frustrated a lot of fans was the idea that Luke Skywalker, who sees the best in everyone and believes in the best in everyone, would try to kill his nephew, even if he didn't actually try to kill his nephew. It was just a moment of weakness. And I think that I can understand, but also we know that Luke has always been someone who acts instinctually and often from a place of fear. So all of that is a rather rambly way of saying I'm not wholly opposed to the transformation that we see in The Last Jedi. There are ways in which I wish it was handled differently, but it's not anything that I ever felt like I needed to gnash my teeth and tweet angrily at Rian Johnson about. I could tweet angrily at him for other things.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's tough, right? You come in with these expectations, especially from the expanded universe. We'll talk about that in a minute. But you have these views about how this guy should behave, how powerful he should be, how active he should be. And if your idea of Luke Skywalker is what he does at the end of the movie, but for real, in terms of taking on the whole First Order himself, this is just jarring. And it can almost feel insulting because, you know, you see him on a journey of getting more powerful. By the time of Return of the Jedi, he's mastered a lot of his abilities, and you expect that that journey will continue. You know, it's not so much that you're against Luke growing, it's that you think he's going to grow in one direction, and you can't conceive of the idea that this person who is full of hope and strength and confidence could be knocked off course, essentially, and basically driven into hiding by what happens to his nephew. It's jarring, and the fact that we don't really get a lot of the actual intermediary story, we just see it in flashbacks, that's probably also part of what makes it difficult for folks to accept. But I do think that it makes sense for him. And I also, you know, one of the reasons I think Rian Johnson is such a great Star Wars storyteller is because, just in general, he takes risks. And sometimes the risks aren't going to pay off. But I think in this case, it was something that was almost like a shock to the system. And I think it was a good one. So I would say I'm in favor of this this choice with Luke. But I understand why folks who, you know, not even like the loudest, angriest folks, but some of the quieter folks, I can understand why this was not the trajectory they expected for, you know, for Luke.
I would also say that, you know, I'll separate my broader structural issues with this, with the sequel trilogy, because, as you said, this is, you know, we would need a 4-hour podcast to dissect that. But I think I like 9/10 of it, you know? I like the idea of mirroring Luke's sort of progression with that of Obi-Wan or Yoda, people who find themselves in exile, who, you know, reach that level of power and then, you know, through some sort of combination of mistakes and external force, find themselves, you know, in a much darker place. I think that that's a good model. I also like the idea that setting up the conflict with his nephew, setting up that tension would be propulsive for storytelling for the sequel trilogy in general. The thing that I think went awry was that it sort of fundamentally misunderstood how to tease out that aspect of Luke's character. I think Grace said something excellent here when she talks about Luke being bold and impulsive. Him responding to, you know, his nephew's tantalizing of the dark side with something of that caliber would make more sense. Him being overconfident that he could address it, him being, you know, maybe hubristic and thinking, well, there's no way a Skywalker after Anakin could fall to the dark side. Him thinking that, you know, he's seeing too much of the good in someone, underestimating people's capacity to fall to the dark side because he wasn't there for his father's fall. He only got to see the redemption. That to me would make more sense. I think what was particularly jarring was the idea that Luke Skywalker, who had, you know, redeemed Darth Vader of all people through love, would turn on his nephew. And I think that was, it was not so much a development as an invalidation of sorts to me in how he ended Return of the Jedi. And I think that, you know, it's a scenario where I like, you know, almost all of the pieces that click together. They it comes so close to working for me, and then it just sort of, you know, fumbles at the end zone.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great example of how, you know, you can look at the same material and take away different lessons from it, or sort of different. You can project forward based on how Return of the Jedi ends in completely different ways, depending on how you analyze, you know, what Luke did and what he was, kind of what his principles were. But, you know, you mentioned Yoda, and I do want to talk about him for a second, because he is somebody who was a powerful Jedi, was very involved in galactic affairs, and then when things went south, he ran away. He knew that he couldn't defeat the rising darkness on his own. There were very few people left who could help him with that mission, and so he holed up on Dagobah, and he did not get very involved until Luke arrived. And yet, despite there being some strong parallels to what Luke did, fans don't look at that story as something inconsistent. You know, we don't look at Yoda's story when we study it from The Phantom Menace through Return of the Jedi. We don't look at that as a story of incongruities or inconsistent, irrational character behavior. Now, of course, there's a big difference between the two, which is that Yoda's story was told in reverse. So maybe that's my question to start us off here, is do we think that Yoda doesn't get this same attention or the same criticism and skepticism because that story was told in reverse, because by the time they made the prequels, he had to end up on Dagobah so that you couldn't tell that story in a way where he didn't run away, because that was always going to happen?
Well, I think in general, we have hit on one of our classic Star Wars discussions problems, which is how much of this can you consider within universe and how much of it has to be colored by the meta knowledge that these movies came out in the wrong order and that necessarily affects who the characters are and their development. But if we look at it from just a purely in-universe standpoint, I do think that there may be a little bit of incongruity with Yoda of the prequel series and then Yoda of the original trilogy. 'Cause in the prequels, he is a badass. He has this lightsaber duel with Count Dooku in episode 2 and then with Darth Sidious in episode 3. And then he just decides to go off and self-imposed exile. So I think on the surface, that could be seen as something that doesn't quite make sense. But at the same time, Yoda is a character who really feels failure and the depth of his failure. And so I think by the end of episode 3, it does make sense that he would turn and hide and go to Dagobah, because he feels as if he has failed in every way that is possible to fail. And we also see his sort of humor and a little funky presence in the prequels, which then are expanded in the original trilogy narrative. But I think the comparison of Luke to Yoda is an interesting one, because in a lot of ways they really are echoes of each other. And it's the same with Obi-Wan being an echo of Yoda and Luke being an echo of Obi-Wan, just like Matt mentioned. It's just the hard thing is that Luke is a protagonist and Yoda isn't. Even if we think about it purely in universe standpoint, Yoda is not one of the core characters in a way that Luke is. So the changes made to Luke's character can feel a lot more personal for that reason, as well as just the narrative of, yeah, those movies came out first, so we had to change it.
I think almost as well. I'm glad you brought up the meta narrative, because when I think of, you know, you can almost take that the other direction too. Like, what if we imagined what this narrative would look like if the prequel trilogy didn't exist? Imagine that they had released the original trilogy, and then now we never found out what the Clone Wars were. We never found out how the Jedi fell. And then we get the sequel trilogy. I think that would be almost better. It would almost work better, because you have this constant drumbeat of teachers failing their students. Because you don't know all the corruption and all the things Palpatine did. You don't know all the manipulations. You only know that Obi-Wan failed and turned to the dark side, and thus Anakin turned to the dark side. You only know that, you know, I'm sorry, that Obi-Wan failed. You only know that Yoda was somehow part of that as well, and he was unable to stop things. In that context, it makes more sense to have a follow-up echo beat of Luke also running into that same failure. We know now, because of the prequel trilogy, that this was extremely uncommon, that the Jedi Order was a much more holistic organization where people generally lived by the light side of the Force, that it suffused the galaxy in this period. I think it's an interesting challenge where it almost seems at times like the sequel trilogy was made, obviously as a sequel to the original trilogy, but without really taking into account what we had learned from the prequels. It's as if they had just jumped from 1983 to 2017.
Yeah, I like the idea of how would the sequel trilogy be viewed if it came after the original trilogy, as opposed to, you know, some years after the prequels, which themselves came several decades after the originals. There's probably a bunch of ways in which the sequels would be, you know, perhaps appreciated differently or just viewed differently without the context of the prequels. They might even be disliked even more if they were immediately following the three movies that people consider to be the best generally. But I do think it's interesting, you know, I want to unpack a little bit what you were saying before, Matt, about how there's a difference between Yoda's failure and Luke's failure, where Luke, based on what you would expect from him at the end of Return of the Jedi, is quick to judge, you know, Ben Solo slash Kylo Ren, and it, you know, in a way that we wouldn't have expected from him, because we would think of him as somebody who's always looking for the good in other people. And I guess I wonder how much, like, to what extent Yoda is also guilty of that, in terms of not stepping out there himself and trying to redeem Vader. I mean, he very quickly, you know, when Luke comes to train with him, it's all about you must defeat Vader, and Luke is the one who's saying there's good in him, right? Which goes back to his fundamental sort of that's the light side in him. Do we fault Yoda for similarly turning away from what we would imagine in the prequel era is perhaps more faith in people? He has a lot less faith by the time of Empire Strikes Back.
I mean, I think that's part of the genius of Return of the Jedi. People give it, you know, crap for the Ewoks and stuff like that, and I certainly wish Lucas had made them Wookiees instead. But it's so brilliant to build up this iconic mythological representation of evil, and then defeat him not through superior swordsmanship, superior force of arms, through some sort of trickery, but just through love and compassion. That's, I think, what had really distinguished Star Wars from other aspects of science fiction, other sort of stories. I think that's what really made it resonant for so many years. At the same time, Yoda is right. Like, they have seen Darth Vader single-handedly dismantle the Jedi Order that had lasted for 10,000 years. It was ridiculous to think that you could actually redeem Darth Vader. It's a one in a million shot. And so I don't really fault Yoda so much for that. But at the same time, I think that basic theme, that brilliance in Return of the Jedi, that love is actually the most powerful force here, that hate and fear, yes, they can be powerful dark side emotions, but love can equally counter and rise to meet them. I think that's the really brilliant part in Return of the Jedi. I think that's the part they squandered in The Last Jedi. That this idea that isn't as animating force, that no matter, you know, that just the dark side almost seems stronger in that sense, which is something that they repeatedly hammer home is not the case. It's quicker, more seductive, yes, but it's not stronger. Love is what's the enduring force there.
Matt, I love love. I really enjoy how you just synthesized pretty much my favorite thing about Star Wars and what makes it so special, because when it is at its best, it is about the power of love and the power of that triumphing over everything else, even in the darkest of moments. So I, first of all, just really appreciate the way that you outlined that. But I will say, I always think we can fault Yoda. And just from a narrative standpoint, he represents the arrogance and the brittleness of the Jedi Order at the end of the Republic, where despite all of his wisdom, his age, his knowledge, his training, and his love for his fellow Jedi and the Padawans, he was unable to pierce the cloud that Sidious had been fomenting and that had been forming under the Jedi Order's noses for a very long time. And I do think that the Jedi Order failed Anakin as a child, or at the very least didn't treat him in the way that he needed. And Yoda's a big part of that. So at this point, we're getting far more deep and detailed into, can we really fault Yoda for saying, hey, you should kill Darth Vader? Because I agree, I don't think we should fault him for that. I do think we should fault him for contributing to the decline of the Jedi Order as a whole. But that may be getting into another episode territory.
And you know what? Probably an episode that we should do, because I think there's interesting avenues that we could go down there. So we've compared Luke and Yoda in terms of How reasonable are their in-universe journeys? You know, if you're a fan of them when you first meet them, chronologically, that is. And of course, the meta-narrative here complicates things. But if you're a fan of the early depiction of the character, can you justify what comes next? And can you see it as being a natural progression? I want to broaden things out a little bit and talk about really one of the biggest challenges that Lucasfilm faces, which is that, you know, you're a business, you're trying to create content that you can sell, that people will buy, and so you need people to like what you're doing. At the same time, you're a creative enterprise, you want to recruit writers who are interested in telling stories in your universe. They're going to have interesting ideas for how to put new twists on characters that are familiar, and sometimes it's just as simple as, people really love this person, what if we showed them in a different light? That's provocative, that will get people to pay attention. So these two things are sometimes in tension, right? And I guess I want to open up this part of the discussion by asking if you were running Lucasfilm, right, how would you try to balance those two things? How would you try to take into account what the audiences want to see, what they expect to see, and maybe what they need to see?
It's a balancing act. And I know that sounds simplistic, but it really is, because you have two competing goals, right? Or two competing, rather, obstacles. I guess like a Scylla and Charybdis sort of thing. On one hand, you can't just make something completely new. It has to be resonant. It has to build on a foundation that was laid down. It has to satisfy a certain amount of audience expectations, that they're not just going to see some people with laser swords fighting, that they're going to see a Star Wars film and all of the things that a Star Wars film entails. But at the same time, you can't be so stifled by that that you don't innovate. And again, this is very like, oh wow, it's so easy for me to say this on a podcast instead of, you know, in a Hollywood writer's room. But those are the two sort of obstacles that they face. And I think that we see the two films in the first two films in the prequel trilogy. They didn't make a third one. It was canceled because of COVID or something.
All right, settle down.
But the first two, you know, you see with Force Awakens, which I remember when I saw that come out, I was blown away. I thought it was fantastic. I watched it again a few months later on Blu-ray, and I realized that it was basically just A New Hope over again. And that it had some good twists. I liked the characters. I liked the characterizations. I liked some of the mysteries that were introduced, which, you know, I could go on for about J.J. Abrams for 3 hours if you wanted me to. But that gave something promising. Last Jedi, I was intrigued by Last Jedi. I say that I like 9/10 of the Luke Skywalker characterization. I think that applies generally to the film as well. I like 9/10 of what they did in it. And the last 10th really for me was just the only part that outweighed that. I didn't think it flowed structurally. I give them a lot of credit for trying some things. I give them a lot of demerits for not being able to pull it off in the third film. And we can get into the meta narratives of that, of how studio control, how writerly influence, how the apparent clashes and tensions that were involved there sort of affected the final creative product. But those are the two things that really stand out to me, is you have to find a happy medium there. And I think what we've seen, we have seen versions where that has worked, right? We have seen Dave Filoni take over the Clone Wars and adapt that fairly successfully. I think that's very widely beloved within modern Star Wars fandom. It's respected. You've seen, you know, Mandalorian, especially at first, you know, maybe it's shifted a bit in later seasons, but especially at first, has been recognized as an innovative way to both hearken to earlier Star Wars, but also build upon it. It's not impossible, but it's formidable. It's a formidable challenge. And I, in hindsight, with the benefit of that hindsight, I'm disappointed that the sequel trilogy fell short, but I'm not surprised. I mean, you know, it had sky high expectations and significant hurdles to overcome. And it struggled.
Yeah, I would very much agree with all of those points, and just add that this is why, ultimately, if you make me choose between Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker, despite all of my issues with The Last Jedi, I would choose it every day, because at least it tried something new. It tried something creative, story-wise, character-wise, visually, and it didn't always succeed. But we've talked before about how there was an overreaction to the backlash from The Last Jedi, perhaps in part contributing to the mess that we see in Rise of Skywalker. But that itself just speaks to all of those conflicting tensions that Matt just outlined. And when you started talking about this, Eric, it really made me think of the character Thrawn, who is a character who showed up in the Expanded Universe books. And then once the Expanded Universe was scrapped, the character is just such a good character, such a good villain, anti-hero, that then the same author who wrote the original books, Timothy Zahn, wrote a new Thrawn trilogy. And I can't remember if Thrawn appearing in Rebels came before or after the publication of the new Thrawn trilogy.
I want to say that was before, but probably very close in time.
Right. I think it was close in time, but Thrawn being repurposed for Rebels and then for his own new books, I think that's a really good example of how you can update a character who, for in this case, was no longer canon, but still very much kept the essence of who he was originally. And I think it's, again, different scenario because he wasn't canon and then became canon again. But it's possible to do that with more beloved characters, where if you have someone who really understands the characters working on updating it, in theory, that should make it make the update work. And we're seeing a real test of that with the Ahsoka show and Dave Filoni, the creator of Ahsoka, the character in the Clone Wars in 2008 or whatever, now being in charge of this live action Ahsoka show. And so can the man who created Ahsoka successfully update her character? And that has very much yet to be seen. But in theory, that's the way that you have a successful update, by being true to who the original character was while still understanding that blend of needs for what the character needs to do now.
I think Ahsoka and Thrawn are interesting examples, because I don't know that I would say that Thrawn is a good example of somebody who was portrayed in a new light, I guess, or portrayed like I don't think that he's comparable to Luke, because Timothy Zahn basically just rewrote, not rewrote, but basically just redid, you know, Thrawn books, with Thrawn being the same guy that he was in the Thrawn trilogy. I mean, the books took place at a different time, but he was the same person, right? The stories about his early life and coming into the Imperial service, there was some kind of growth, you know, when he was at the Imperial Academy and he was a little bit younger and he was trying to get used to this political system. But really after that, once he gets out there and is commanding a ship, he's the same Thrawn that he was throughout the Thrawn trilogy from the 1990s. Whereas Ahsoka, as portrayed in the current live action series, is at a different point in her life from when we got to know her and fell in love with her. She's grown, she's matured, and as we will talk about in our Ahsoka episode, she's portrayed very differently. So I think, you know, now, I having said that about Thrawn basically being copied and pasted into canon as the same person, having said that, we could see a different Thrawn in the Ahsoka show and in the Dave Filoni movie that's going to be coming up about the big fight between Thrawn and the New Republic. We could see a Thrawn who is portrayed differently there, akin to Luke, where some time passes and you see him in a different light. But the Thrawn that we've seen in canon so far is basically the same Thrawn that we saw in the Expanded Universe. So it's almost like Lucasfilm was like, you know what? We don't want to have to deal with the problem that we're eventually going to face with Luke, where people don't like the new version of this character. We're going to bring him in and we're going to make him the same guy, because that's what fans expect. And frankly, it was very successful. So we could be talking about a whole different Thrawn when we do our Ahsoka show. They could do something like The Last Jedi, where they do an edgy, kind of controversial, provocative new version of Thrawn. But so far, I think he's the same guy. I think he's kind of an example of Lucasfilm being cautious and not wanting to rock the boat when they portray a beloved character after some period of time. They basically did the same guy, at least as far as I'm concerned.
That's a fair point. I'm sorry, Matt. I just want to respond very quick. I would say that's a fair point. I do think having his sidekick slash the Watson to his Holmes, Eli Banto, kind of changes the dynamic. But I guess my point is more about changing the context of a character rather than the character themselves. But you make some fair points, Eric. Okay, sorry. You go, Matt.
No, I just want to add, I don't want to get too much into the weeds on Ahsoka, because as you say, that's you're going to have an Ahsoka show. But also for reasons that I think fit into this, which is that I want to see the full product first. You know, I'm optimistic about a lot of what I'm seeing in Ahsoka right now. I have some questions that I hope will be answered, but I don't want to prejudge before they're answered. I think that's what, for me, sort of doomed the sequel trilogy, is that as a cohesive whole, it did not work. And I mean that in the sense that it's completely different from the other two trilogies, where you have the original trilogy. It was designed to be one film. They have to come up with a second one and a third one. Lucas was very clearly writing those on the fly, which is why, you know, the sibling thing, you know, having to backtrack on his father, all these things were introduced. It turns out okay. I mean, obviously, because it's a beloved American cultural icon. And then you have sort of the opposite, where he was able to go in, Lucas, and sort of write the entire original trilogy from scratch. And you get the sense that he's laying down things in episode one that will pay off in episode three. He's laying down things in episode two that are necessary to connect one to three. Obviously, the films have their own foibles because, you know, Lucas is a good director, but not a perfect one. He's a good storyteller, but not a perfect one. Those foibles sort of make them iconic in their own way, but there's a sense of cohesiveness, a sense of unity of purpose and of storytelling and of vision. And we just didn't have that with the sequel trilogy. We had competition, we had reversals, we had directors trying to overwrite and invalidate each other's perspectives. I mean, the Rey parentage saga is unbelievable to watch a few years removed later. How did a studio let them zigzag like that? Because I remember, I don't know what your personal experiences were for watching Rise of Skywalker the first time. When Rey's parentage is revealed in the third film, people in the theater I was in laughed, which I have never seen before in a film like that, where the audience just openly, actively rejects a plot point like that. So I'm willing to give Ahsoka a little more runway, because for me, it has to flow together cohesively. I'm hopeful that maybe Disney has learned from its mistakes in this regard, but we'll have to tune in and see.
Well, maybe that's the real secret to fixing this problem that you identified, Matt, of having all of these competing pressures from the fans, from the studio. The important thing is to have a cohesion of vision, which, again, easier said than done, as we are armchair quarterbacking from our humble little podcast. But I think one of the stronger elements of the first season of The Mandalorian is that it's very cohesive. And then in the next two seasons, that cohesion kind of falls away and it becomes more clear that they don't really know what they're doing. The most successful arcs of the Clone Wars series, and I think the Rebels series as a whole, they have a very cohesive vision, and that's why they work. And as you're saying, with the prequel trilogy, I mean, they are deeply flawed movies, but there is a vision there. And so maybe what they really need is to have that vision. And so even if you make a decision that fans aren't going to like about a character, you know, even if they make the wrong decision about Luke, let's say they did all over again, Last Jedi again, they made those mistakes, let's say Rise of Skywalker, they stuck with them. Like, they just, they kept the characterizations that they had previously set up. Even if the movie had still failed, I think it would have ended up being a stronger movie than what Rise of Skywalker was. And the problem with cohesive vision is that you need to have someone directing it. And who should that be? Should that be George Lucas? Should that be Dave Filoni? How do you handle the studio pressures? But I think that should, there should be a vision of some sort. And right now, it's not clear who's guiding it. And I think that's why Star Wars can feel adrift, and or why when you have Andor, for example, it feels freaking great because there's a vision for it.
Right. And we've seen, we know that this problem is not completely fixed, not only because of The Mandalorian, which I'm glad you brought up, the later seasons, but I think to build on that, even a better example is the Book of Boba Fett, which has sort of been memory hold because for very obvious reasons, it was not worth remembering. But I started the Book of Boba Fett thinking, oh, good, I'm going to learn more about Boba Fett. And it very quickly turned into the Din Djarin and Grogu variety hour, which is not what I was promised by no less than the show's title. And that's really an effect where I got that it's really a show where not only does it take me out as a viewer from enjoying the actual product, but it also takes me out as somebody who thinks about constructing storylines, that how did this happen? Like, what studio pressure was exerted on whom? What merchandising things needed to happen for this to turn out this way? And I think we that gives me pause in passing judgment or expecting too much optimism, too much pessimism on Ahsoka just yet, because I need to see them stick the landing. I need to see how this wraps up, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Andor too, because, you know, it almost reminds me of, like, in the days of the Roman Republic, when they would just have a dictator who they would just say, like, you know what, here is unlimited power, fix this problem. And then when it's over, you walk away and we'll go back to having an elected leadership. It's almost what they did with Andor, where they basically gave Tony Gilroy carte blanche to tell the story as he wanted without feeling like he had to bring in the typical Star Wars production designers or composers or focus on the typical Star Wars themes or characters. And this is not to say that Tony Gilroy saved Star Wars or fixed Star Wars, but the success of the show was the result of him being allowed to take risks with the tone. It's not the same thing as Luke Skywalker and taking risks with his journey. That's more of a story thing. This is more of a tone thing. But they're related in terms of how much does Disney want to let creators take chances and depart from the norm. I think it's easier to do in the Andor context, where what you're doing differently is the tone. You're not taking a character that fans already know and putting them into a new context and saying, you thought that he would be here, but actually he's over here. And of course, the main character who we did already know is very much on the same journey that is going to bring him to where we last saw him, because it's the same creator. So that part, it wasn't as dicey, again, because going back to what you guys were talking about before, about having one creative vision, Tony Gilroy's creative vision was in Rogue One and Andor. So character journey-wise, we're not in that Luke Skywalker problem territory. But I want to just kind of go back to this question of fan expectations and bring in the expanded universe as a complicating factor, because it isn't just that creators want to do provocative things and take characters to new places, where we're just looking at canon and what we've seen in canon, where we're just looking at Luke Skywalker in Return of the Jedi to Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi. There's also the Luke Skywalker in all the books and comics that were set after Return of the Jedi that are not canon, that were in the expanded universe, that showed him being a pretty, you know, I mean, he was a badass, right? He was super powerful, and he was out there fighting, and he was leading a new Jedi Order, and he was at the forefront. Do we think that perhaps even more so than expectations from the end of the original trilogy, is really what got folks mad, because they weren't just doing a zigzag from when we last saw him in canon. They were overwriting, in many fans' opinions, the personality that they expected him to have at that same point in time from this parallel universe, if you will, of the expanded universe. How much did that material play a role in upsetting people, and how much does Lucasfilm have to worry about that as they tell stories about these characters that are going to take place at the same time as expanded universe material, including the Dave Filoni movie with Thrawn against the New Republic?
It absolutely is a huge problem. And I think that you alluded to something, and I was if you weren't going to bring up the expanded universe, I was, because you talk about Andor, you talk about Tony Gilroy having the ability to flesh out his vision. That's what the expanded universe used to be. There was an implicit sort of social contract between everybody involved, between Lucas, between the publishing companies and the comic book companies and the fans, that there's two tiers of canonicity here. There's the films, which are Lucas's perfected and authentic vision for the Star Wars universe. And then there's the sandbox that everybody else gets to play in. And the sandbox is great. Lucas has pillaged from the sandbox many times. That's where Coruscant came from. But at the same time, he's also ignored stuff. Some of the early concepts for what the Clone Wars were supposed to be, as it was described in the expanded universe, did not become what it was. And so I think that if Lucasfilm, or not Lucasfilm, Disney shifts towards a model where they're giving that sort of sandbox for people to play in, and we see elements of that. We see the High Republic stuff. We see the Andor stuff. We see these elements of people operating outside of the mainline storyline, having that freedom. I think that would be really positive. It's when they cross over into the mainstream that they do. And just to pivot more directly to your question, it's a huge problem because it gives people a baked in alternative. It presents an alternative universe for them to compare and contrast with. And
right. It's not theoretical. They can actually point to something where the characters are different.
I mean, I'm honestly surprised that they're going to do a Thrawn movie, because you have to then compare that to the most celebrated novels ever written for Star Wars, with the exception of perhaps the Darth Plagueis one and the Return of the Revenge of the Sith novelization. But the Thrawn stuff is the gold standard. I mean, Timothy Zahn, that's the thing that everybody compares every other Star Wars novel to. And that's setting up a very high bar of expectations. The advantage that Disney has is that, you know, it can draw upon that stuff. The disadvantage is that it, you know, you have expectations to meet.
Yeah. I think in so many ways, the discarding of the expanded universe was, in the eyes of many fans, the original sin of Disney purchasing Lucasfilm and deciding what to do next. And in some ways, it doesn't even really make sense, because they could have still made new movies just based on what was already out there. I think that a lot of good things have come from the Disney-owned Lucasfilm. Some of my favorite shows and some really good books. But I do think that in a lot of ways, getting rid of the expanded universe was just an unforced error. Because first of all, it pissed off a lot of people who, you know, Star Wars is a huge, huge brand. They're going to be normal people who show up to any Star Wars movie. It's not a cult thing. It's not like the only people who are watching it are the total freaks, like us included. Regular, non-obsessed people will watch these movies. But it was still, they pissed off a universe of people who really, really cared, seemingly for no apparent reason other than to make money and sort of do what they wanted, shamelessly pillage from the expanded universe, but ultimately make their own action figures and mash them together.
We might actually have to debate this, because I actually think it was a good decision, and it would not have been tenable to keep things the way that it was before. So that's perhaps a different episode, but yes. Fundamentally disagree.
Well, I'll take the split decision here, which is that they didn't really have a choice, and I think that's not necessary. I mean, Disney, I think, has realized whatever errors they've made in discarding that too hastily. But the problem with the expanded universe is that it revolves so heavily around Han, Luke, and Leia. And the problem with human existence is that Carrie Fisher, Harrison Ford, and Mark Hamill are a finite resource. They cannot make, you know, 12 films about the Yuuzhan Vong War, because the three main actors of the original trilogy will not be around when the 12th one is made.
Because I would buy every ticket in every theater and just watch it all day for weeks, and they would never, nobody else would get to see the movie.
Right. Disney would make too much money, and then we would have a French Revolution on our hands. But yeah, I think that we see Disney implicitly realizing this in the sequel trilogy when they spend one by one each film killing off various members of the original trilogy. I mean, you have Han Solo gratuitously dying in the first one. You have Luke heroically sacrificing himself. That's the one part of his characterization that really I thought was they knocked out of the park in terms of like giving him sort of a crowning badass moment to go out on, force projecting himself from the other side of the galaxy. That was great stuff. And then you have, you know, the Carrie Fisher saga, which is again a meta thing where her own death sort of forced their hand on a few story elements. But the intent that, you know, you step back, even if you take out Carrie Fisher's premature demise, they were trying to avoid the problem that they would have run into if they had skewed too closely to the expanded universe, which is that they're not going to have those actors around, and they didn't have the technology at that point to just like clone them and digitize them like they do in The Mandalorian. And I think I think that maybe they could have done it in a different way, but I disagree that it was sort of an A-B switch that they had to make. It was really sort of a balancing of competing interests that they had to fulfill.
And you see this with the stories that they're about to start telling, which are very conspicuously not in this era of Star Wars, right? I mean, yes, we have Ahsoka. We're going to have the Dave Filoni movie. We're also going to have this Skeleton Crew TV show, which is kind of like an Amblin Entertainment meets Star Wars. But then we're going to have a movie about the origins of the Force set, you know, way, way back, thousands of years earlier. And we're going to have a Rey movie, which, you know, yes, it's sort of after the Skywalker saga, but it's a clean break from the Skywalker saga, and it's about kind of the new generation. And then we've got The Acolyte, which is the High Republic show, of course, following up on the High Republic publishing initiative, which has been very successful and very interesting. I encourage folks to check that out. So this is all them saying, we understand that we've got to redefine what Star Wars means. Yep. And I think Star Wars is unique in terms of how much of the success has been built on chronologically a very tiny window of time and a handful of characters. That is sort of a prison that they're trying to break out from now, and it helps them avoid the sort of the big topic we've been talking about, which is having to tell stories about characters that fans have seen for a long time and having to dance in between the raindrops of bringing something new while not disappointing people's long-held expectations.
And again, I could spend three. I promise I'm not going to do this. I internally promised myself beforehand, I'm not going to spend 3 hours ranting about J.J. Abrams. Although if you give me a podcast of 3 hours to do it, I will do it. But I would join you. I mean his understanding of space alone is just mind blowing. Okay, what I will say is that I can see why when Lucasfilm was mapping out this trilogy, they thought, you know who would be great at this. Is J.J. Abrams, because he had that he sort of squared the circle of and cut the Gordian knot and whatever other cliche I can pull out of my ass here. He did this with Star Trek, where he realized that, you know, the best way to satisfy everyone is to set those films in a sort of parallel timeline with younger people. That does not invalidate the earlier work. The original crew of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, they go on to do whatever they do. They live their lives. They have all sorts of fun. But now you're able to retell those stories and tell new stories through the other crew. And I think Star Trek, again, that's another podcast, is how Star Trek is confronting that on their own conundrum there. But he solved that circle by creating an alternate universe. But there are no parallel universes in Star Wars. There's no time travel in Star Wars. And so they really have to sort of kill their sacred cows. And it's just a matter of how they do it. Can they pull it off? And I think that the overwhelming response from the public was that in the sequel trilogy, they failed.
I just want to clarify that the argument that I was making about discarding the expanded universe, not necessarily something I feel. I'm more agnostic on it, but that's the argument that I think a lot of fans make, and that made a lot of fans angry in a way that I understand the reasoning behind it, and I think both of you make great points. But if we're talking about the purely emotional fan gut reaction, mm-hmm. and, you know, Star Wars fans, we are famous for being very emotional about this media property. A lot of people were very upset about it. And yeah, all of those things are true, that you couldn't have Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, and Harrison Ford doing the same thing over and over again, if only because Eric would buy all of the tickets, and then that would be the true destruction of the movie industry. But sometimes these things aren't logical, and especially when it comes to Star Wars fandom, when people consider the way that their favorite storylines have changed, their favorite characters have changed, it feels personal in a way that it doesn't for a lot of other media properties. And I think there's a whole other podcast we could have about the way that Star mm-hmm. Wars is embedded in American culture, to the extent that people feel personally victimized by Luke Skywalker being different in The Last Jedi. And I think that when you just look at it from that emotional standpoint, you're never going to be able to satisfy everybody. So then the question becomes, do you try to satisfy anybody, or do you just kind of go your own way? And that's the intractable problem that we keep coming back to.
And I don't want to say that your original point, or that those fans' concerns, is wrong, because I think Disney validated them to a significant degree by tossing out the expanded universe and then immediately introducing Kylo Ren, who is basically a very watered down, very stripped down, very, very bland version of Jason Solo, who was for those who aren't deep in the lore, who are somehow still listening to a Star Wars podcast, was Han and Leia's son, who turns to the dark side. He eventually has to confront Luke for his many, many, many sins. That's a very well-established, well-entrenched, very famous expanded universe storyline that fans had followed for probably about a decade. I mean, I remember reading Jason and Jaina Solo books when I was in elementary school, and then I remember reading his ultimate fate in college. I think it was in college. I might be fuzzy on the years there. But I mean, that was a major storyline that lasted a long time. And they adapted an extremely weak version that at first glance seemed to be stolen from it, and did it poorly. I think fans have a right to feel that, even if they can intellectually understand the expanded universe wasn't tenable as a roadmap for what Disney was going to do, Disney couldn't have handled it much worse than by taking a core storyline from it and just running it into the ground.
Absolutely. And then that gets into sort of like, you know, how do you, like, certain things are just too good to ignore, right? That archetype, that trope of, like, the next generation has similar problems with the dark side, and Luke has to sort of be now the kind of Obi-Wan figure. There was no way that they were going to do the sequel trilogy without having some version of that. And so then it gets into, well, you've already said that all of this stuff is not the authoritative story anymore, and you're also going to be tempted to pull some of those archetypes and some of those tropes into canon. So how do you do it in a way that meets fans' expectations? But also, you know, they decanonized that stuff for a reason, which is that some of it was very hokey and very corny and very bad. And so if you want to do, and I don't know that the Jason Solo story is the perfect example of this, but some of it was corny and bad. But if you want to do a Jason Solo type story, you're probably going to change certain things just because that's not necessarily the best way to do that story. And you have people with the benefit of hindsight who are saying, let's have him do this instead of this. And to fans, that is going to look like you robbed this tomb of the concepts, and then you didn't even execute it the way that we liked. to Lucasfilm, it's we took the ideas that, by the way, we created and we did them better in a more cohesive way that matches what we were already doing. I don't know that you can ever reconcile those two perspectives. But Grace, you're absolutely right that this continues to be one of the enduring tensions in Star Wars fandom, even long after the decision was made, which is that all these stories are being analyzed and assessed based on the sort of shadow parallel universe of what could have been if that stuff were still canon. All right, well, we're going to wrap things up here. This has been a fantastic discussion. Matt Ford, thank you so much for coming on Hoth Takes. I really enjoyed having you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
And if folks want to follow Matt on social media, he is FordM, F-O-R-D-M on Twitter, and he is M Ford on Blue Sky. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Hoth Takes. If you want to share your thoughts or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it. We are Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers. And Haley, who could not be on this episode, but we hope to have her back soon, is Burdenator. Speaking of Haley, she made our wonderful logo and banner art, and I edited the show and put together our music. Although, of course, for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars music and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, and that is hothtakes.wordpress.com. And hey, if you like the show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. All right, we'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.